Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and it's a new year, a new realm. It feels like every year in this curious planet of ours, things become ever more peculiar, even as the saying goes, they stay kind of the same. As people familiar with this show know, one of our main, or my main obsessions or themes is magic in its many guises. I love the fact that the same word combines so many different meanings: performance magic, occult magic, skeptical tricks, and supernatural claims. And I think I really became interested with magic when a couple of years ago I went through Las Vegas and this conjurer named Paul Vigil wanted to hang on. I think I might have mentioned this on the show once. And he had liked some of my writings, and he was a psychonaut and a very curious character, as many magicians are. And we went to his house, and he just did some sleight of hand that just blew my mind. And it's a common experience for people who are interested in magic. I think it's particularly true with sleight of hand, where you're confronted with something, you don't believe at all that there's anything magical going on, supernatural. You know, on some fundamental level, that what you're seeing is the manipulation of objects in space and time, and particularly the manipulation of your own perceptual system and its gaps, its tendencies, its own errancy as it creates an ongoing picture of the world. And yet, nonetheless, your mind is blown. You are absolutely astonished. You are filled with wonder, with strangeness, even a slightly disturbing sense, even a temptation to believe, just for a moment, that time and space may not be exactly the way you thought they were, or at least that the mind is not the way that you thought it was. And what I learned from Paul, which was very interesting, is the different ways that magicians play with this kind of power. Some use it to entertain, some use it to give themselves power, some use it in the service of precisely that sense of astonishment and surreality, and some, as we'll discover in today's show, use it to reveal things about how the brain actually works. As you can imagine, I was very happy when I saw the announcement for this new book, Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions, by Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde. We're hunting them down now. I'm not sure if they're online yet, so as we wait to make them magically appear over the quote-unquote airwaves with I'll introduce our co-host, Maja Dau, who's calling in from somewhere on the planet Earth, right? You are on the planet Earth, Maja.
I totally am.
Good. You sound good there. And you and I, we've been to the Magic Castle. We're both magic fans. You know some magicians personally. What would you say, if you had to kind of make a guess, their main motivations are in their performance? Is it tricking people? Is it astonishing people? Is it goofing? Is it showing people how they don't have a full vision of reality? What would you say, the folks that you know best?
Man, I have to say it runs the gamut. I mean, for each magician, they have their own kind of ulterior motive. I think it's all of those things that you listed. Like, some are just kind of geeks that turned into, like, power trippers because they can, like, trick people's brains, and for them that's, like, a kind of domination weird thing. And the other ones are just like pranksters that think it's fun and funny. And then there's some that want to open up that awe and wonder in you, like you mentioned. But literally, I have seen the gamut of those kind of inspirations with magicians, and I can say I think with total certainty that with each magician, they have their own kind of intricate backstory for which inspiration they choose when they're doing a trick on someone, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things I think is so fascinating about the magic subculture. I think it's one of the most interesting things out there is the variety of motivations, of nuances, of what, when you boil it down to, are a relatively small number of principles and core tricks that manifest themselves in so many different ways. So with that, I'd like to bring on Dr. Stephen Macnick, along with his, I don't know, is Susanna there as well, Steve?
It's me and Dr. Susanna Martinez-Conde here.
Hello.
Wonderful. I'm glad you're both there. You both work at the Laboratory of Behavioral Neurophysiology at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix. And is that the oldest neurological institute in America?
Yes, it is. And that laboratory is mine. Susanna's laboratory is the Laboratory of Visual Neuroscience.
Wonderful. Well, it sounds like you have a good scene there. Well, I think one place just to start off with this wonderful book, I just want to make one comment about it and have you respond. One of the things I loved about it is I had seen some of your articles in various magazines that were talking about the research you were doing that shows the way that magic, conjuring magic, can reveal a great deal about cognitive science, about the way that our minds construct reality. And I thought, okay, so these are some, you know, neuroscientists who are, you know, studying magician. That seems to make sense. Someone was going to do it. And then, you know, and I learned a great deal from your book. But what I really enjoyed about your book, in addition to what I learned, was the clear evidence that you guys became total magic groupies, that you weren't just like, you know, oh, this is interesting, we can do some lab studies here. It's like you really got into it. So tell me about how you guys got into magic and that, a little bit about that journey.
Steve? Okay. So, the way we got into this actually was from a totally perpendicular trajectory, because, you know, we didn't really have, even though we studied illusions for decades now, that we didn't really have a fundamental interest in magic until the original idea to do this came up. So we were actually asked to organize a conference in Las Vegas, a scientific conference about the nature of consciousness and attention in the brain in 2007. And so when we started planning this conference, we were driving up and down the strip trying to meet with hotel managers and restaurant managers, planning a conference, and we're trying to think of a way, how are we going to bring the public into this conference, you know? What can we do to get the public interested in attention and awareness? And kind of Las Vegas gave us the answer for us, because as we were driving up and down the strip, we kept passing by these 100-foot-tall signs of magicians, and Penn and Teller pasted on a bus, and Matt King over there on a billboard, and we realized that magicians were the artists of attention and awareness. And just like as vision scientists, we can study visual artists in order to better understand how the visual system works, that we could study magicians as cognitive artists to understand how cognition works. And so, and once we had that idea, it really snowballed, because we realized not only was it a sound idea, but it was a really great idea, because magicians are actually better than scientists at manipulating attention and awareness, that they'd been doing it for a lot longer and their tricks were much more robust. And so this is how it started, and ever since we've been on this journey to learn more about magic and what's happening in the brain, and it's just been very exciting.
Well, but isn't it the case also that you sort of got hooked on it maybe a little deeper than you needed to, even for the purposes of scientific research?
Well, it's deeper than we needed to. That's arguable. We actually felt that we needed to become active, have a first person experience of performing magic in order to better understand what goes into the development and execution of a magic trick. We felt that we still had something missing, even after having talked to many magicians and read books about magic theory and gone to magic conventions and workshops. There was still a missing element, so we felt that we needed to be more immersed in order to better to make better science. But you're right that we also become really captured by magic, and more appreciative of everything that goes into it, and that we've become big magic consumers as well.
So we actually learned to do magic, and we put together our own act in order to audition for the Magic Castle as magician members, and we've now been inducted into the Magic Castle, and that's part of our book of the story of that journey, and also into the Magic Circle in England, and we're members of the Society for American Magicians and the International Brotherhood of Magicians as well.
Yeah, and one of the things I really like about that is it also made me reflect a little bit on the way that psychological experiments, you know, psychologists doing a lot of experiments, that they're also in many ways kind of magic tricks, because there's a lot of misdirection, there's a lot of, you know, telling that the people being studied that the study is about a certain thing, and then it's actually about something else entirely different. So there's a weird way in which the idea of tricking or reframing psychological situations is in some sense already part of cognitive science, at least in terms of psychological studies of human reaction.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right on that.
So yeah, it's a wonderful connection. Well, I think what I'd love to do now a little bit, just to give people a little flavor, as I mentioned at the onset of the show, we've had a lot of magicians on the show, and so people are pretty interested in these topics, is to talk a little bit about some of the features of human cognition that are particularly highlighted and played with, or exploited is another word, by magicians. And there's a number of different things you talk about in your book. I don't know if there's ones that you're particularly interested in, but, you know, choice blindness, confabulation, covert and overt attention and misdirection. So I just have to hear what you guys really found as some of the more arresting examples of how these principles of human psychology are brought forth in magical experience.
Well, the most important, I would say, the most important tool that the magician uses is the, not all magicians like the term misdirection, but there's really no good term, say the misdirection or direction, redirection, manipulation, management of attention. That is critical to a lot of very spectacular magic tricks and magic shows, and something that we, coming from a completely naive perspective into the field of magic, we were surprised to realize that there are different forms of misdirecting the attention of the spectator, and that misdirecting the gaze, that is, getting the spectator to look in one place while the magician does something else in a different location, that's not necessarily the most powerful form of misdirection, and that it is more about misdirecting the attention without necessarily changing the position of gaze, and that this is what we describe with the term that we coined of a covert misdirection versus overt. So overt misdirection, the magician would change the position of gaze of the audience. In covert misdirection, they would change the spotlight of attention without changing the position of gaze, and there the spectator is going to be looking at a critical place and at the critical time, and so they're going to think that they saw everything, but in fact they didn't see everything because their attention was somewhere else, or their attention was split in several locations, so that they were looking at the right place but they were not seeing because their attention was elsewhere.
Yeah, that was a remarkable point for me because, and I think a lot of readers, you know, our naive assumption is that, yes, of course, our attention is being misdirected, but we think about it in a purely physical way, that it's our eyes are looking in one place and something's going on outside of our literal field of vision. And it was really quite remarkable that point about covert misdirection, that actually, you know, in the magical experiences that I've had with great conjurers, that my eyes have actually been where the action was, and yet there was something else going on. So that which is a, you know, a more you know, unnerving realization in a way. It's one thing to acknowledge that our eyes can be distracted, but it's another thing to recognize that our eyes might actually be on the action, and yet through other means, language, expectation, we find ourselves, you know, making up a different story. What about you, Stephen?
Well, I think that one of the things that we learn from magicians that has been important for our, for the science is that laughter or humor can actually suppress attention. And, you know, nobody would be surprised to hear that, magicians use laughter to help distract people during the act. Now, a lot of people think that just see the act and they think that the person is a comedian as well, or they're doing this for entertainment value. And that's largely correct, of course. But also, magicians use jokes in a very specific choreographed times in the in their tricks in order to suppress people's attention so that they can get away with magical murder and, people don't notice it. And this was actually a really important realization because this indicates that there's a very strong component or a very strong link between emotions and attention, which isn't really recognized in the, in neuroscience very much. And it's really important for us to understand this link because there are diseases, for instance, of cognitive decline in which there are emotional components, such as Alzheimer's disease. And so understanding not only how attention works, but how our emotions manipulate our attention is absolutely critical to clinical neuroscience as well as just to understanding how the brain works in general. So this was a really important realization, and we and it brought forth the very real take-home message for us that magicians actually have a corner on the market on studies of certain aspects of human behavior that the scientists have missed.
And is part of that because they're operating on sort of whatever you want to call it, multiple dimensions, or that there's a verbal dimension, there is a gestural performative thing, there are physical tricks, there are, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it, which in a way mirrors what's going on with our own minds, where there's so many different dimensions to what's feeding into our sense of ongoing reality.
We feel that that's an important element. In the laboratory, we tend to dissect all of these different behaviors and forms of experience and just concentrate on one small element that we present and study in isolation of everything else, whereas magicians lump illusion on top of illusion, cognitive, perceptual, optical. They just, in all the different sensory modalities and that from using all cognitive processes of attention and memory and decision making. So it's really, it sort of works like an onion. You have all of these different layers, and even if the spectator manages to peel away a few of them, there's still so much more to it. They're not going to be able to get to the bottom of it. And the other thing to keep in mind is that why magicians have disadvantage in some of these aspects of perception and cognition over scientists is that they have been doing this for much, much longer than we have. They've been doing it for millennia. So even if their method hasn't been as systematic as the scientific method, they still have tried a lot of things and seen what works and seen what doesn't. So their art is quite refined right now.
Well, I have a question for you guys, too, along those lines in terms of going back into time. And I know you guys said the magicians have the corner on the market, but I was curious what you guys think about, like, in nature where we see things like this. Like, to me, in nature, one of the really good magicians is the octopus, right? And they use emotional manipulation through color and visual things where they're like, you know, flash themselves different color to elicit emotional response. They use misdirection by, like, emitting an ink package that'll kind of misdirect the attention of whoever they're trying to trick. They'll use, like, you know, literal visual disguises where they'll camouflage themselves. And how do you guys think, like, something like an octopus would compare to these kind of neurological tricks that a magician would do? Did you guys do any research into, like, how those would kind of compare to the tricks that a magician uses?
Well, I think that, you know, an octopus does use camouflage, which is a type of optical illusion, to hide itself, and for instance can use ink, for instance, to block the octopuses, or to make it unclear where the octopus is in space to deter predators and things like that. The in terms of emotional manipulation, I think really the main point is that magicians are not really going in through the back door of the mind. There aren't any like Easter eggs, as a computer programmer would put it, or a secret path that they're climbing in through the back door of the brain in order to cause these things to happen. That really what they're doing is manipulating processes that we use with each other all the time. They're secret methods, but that doesn't mean the methods aren't based in behaviors that we use when we're discussing things with each other, or negotiating with each other, or manipulating each other's emotions like our children do with us, and you know, that kind of thing all the time. And so they just know that that's what they're trying to do, and that while they're doing that, they've learned that they can get away with certain sorts of secret maneuvers and things like that with their hands in order so that it will result in the appearance that something impossible just happened.
Yeah. And I would emphasize that last point. I think that there's an important difference to keep in mind when you compare a magic performance with a number of, the source of deception that may happen in nature, in other animal species, or in other areas of human behavior. You're going to find outside of magic, you're going to find manipulation of attention and misdirection and memory illusions and all of these things. But in magic, they all serve a concrete goal, which is to create a magical experience. And that is not what the octopus is trying to create. The octopus is trying to get away from danger. And the magician is really trying to create this experience in which what you are perceiving should, but does not appear to match the physical laws of nature.
That's wonderful. I want to talk more about this, the magical experience, in a second, but I wanted to stay with Stephen's comment because I thought it was really, I think it's really key that a lot of the elements that you're talking about in the book, we see are actually embedded in our ordinary practice. I mean, your subtitle about everyday deceptions, and the one that really came through for me was in the discussion of confabulation, about the way that we kind of tell stories using not a great deal of data sometimes, and really hold on to our stories even against contrary evidence. You talk about the way that one of the measures of a great magician is their ability to deal with mistakes or to deal with wrong guesses. And one of the things that they'll do is they'll just keep the performance of authority and magical power going in the face of these errors or mistakes.
That's right.
And then you draw from this an ethical point or a way to practice life, which is to say, when you're cruising along and you make a mistake, just keep rolling. And I've been doing that more recently, and it's remarkable to see the way that we do employ these. We are magicians in our interpersonal dealings, certainly in workplace environments and in dealing with cops and dealing with people who have – and there's some of that play of certainly using that story-making facility that we do all the time.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things I admire the most about magicians, performers in general, but specifically magicians, I think, is their attitude that they've learned as great performers to just keep moving forward. And I think that's a great attitude to carry around in life.
And something that is important to keep in mind in a magic show as well as in life is that the spectator of the magic show doesn't know where the performance is going. They don't know what the next step is going to be in the magic routine. They don't know what the final outcome is going to be, because the magician doesn't typically announce what the final outcome is going to be. It generally comes as a surprise. So they wouldn't really have a good way of knowing if the magician deviates from his original intention, and that's just in the magician's mind, and that to be able to have the flexibility to go off on a tangent if as required by the situation. But that happens in life too. Most of the people around us, whether we're in a conversation or having some interaction at work or at home, people around us don't really know where is it that we intended to get to in the first place. So we have quite a bit of room to maneuver around.
Yeah, we had Max Maven on the show, and I asked him at one point. I said, "You know, I know you're not going to tell me what's going on in some of these mentalist tricks, but it is the case that you're operating without a net. And he went, oh, yes, very much. And that was really the moment where I started to appreciate the art of magic on a really deeper level, was that even if I knew the basic elements that were being used, the basic tricks or the kinds of cognitive principles that are being exploited, even if I don't know the specific form of it, that even with all of that, there's still this live performance. There's still this engagement with a person who has random elements, who might say things you don't know, who, and how you weave that into the continued sort of creation of that magical experience. I'm curious, like, what ways did, after studying magicians, how did you come to appreciate what magic is in a new way?
Well, I think that for me, magic became a real passion in terms of its role in just using so many different possibilities for controlling the perception of somebody. So as a scientist, as Susanna mentioned before, we break down generally a given cognitive effect down to one thing, and then we set up an experiment in which we have two what's called conditions, two different types of things that the person will look at, one with the effect and one without the effect, so we can try and measure the size of the effect. And the problem with this, this is good science, but the problem with this is that what happens is these tricks or these experiments really aren't that robust, because what can happen, you have to be very careful with this, is that the person can figure out what it is you're doing, and they can sometimes they'll affect the results because they figured it out, for instance, by trying to help you get the answer they think you want, which is always a bad thing, or maybe they'll even try and do the opposite if they're feeling a bit naughty, and that can also happen. So we have to go to these extraordinary controls to make sure that our data stays pure, whereas magicians are doing the same kinds of things, but it's incredibly robust that they can do these things night after night, show after show, generation after generation, and these tricks work. And largely it has to do with the fact that they've combined so many different things together, as Santa said, kind of the concept of peeling the onion, that they're able to have this very robust thing. So if someone figures out one thing, it'll still work. And I think that aspect of magic, the thing I appreciate the most, is that we should be applying that to science as well. So in the science, what we could be doing is, instead of having in our experiment one situation or condition in which there was this one effect and then another situation or condition where it wasn't there, what we could have is we could have one situation or condition where there was 10 effects going on, and then another situation where there was the exact same 10 effects, but now an 11th on top of that. And this would be much more like the situation with the magic tricks, where we'd get much stronger results, I think, and it's still comparing, you were still looking at the effect of one thing in the end, because we're comparing one condition to the other and everything's the same except for the one thing we've changed, but we've made it into a very robust magic trick, as it were, that the subject can't see through. And I think that would really improve the rate of discovery in neuroscience.
Well, one other question just to follow on that is, how far do you think this conversation between cognitive science and magic could go? I mean, I mean, one way you could look at the kinds of things you've done is like, oh, look, they found some interesting things from magicians, and oh, yes, there's some good points, and there's a couple of new fields of study. And then another way of saying it's like, actually, this is just the beginning of a very, very rich conversation that might not just inform neuroscience, but actually change the way neuroscience is done in some ways. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. We think that this we're merely scratching the surface, and this conversation can go very, very far indeed. In fact, we assert in Flights of Mind, and this is our honest opinion, that if we were to know precisely the neural basis of how magic works in the mind of the spectator, then we would know the neural basis of consciousness itself, which is the holy grail of cognitive neuroscience.
Yeah, this is great stuff. So I want to get into that in the second half of the show, but right now we're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Stephen Maknick and Susanna Martinez-Conde, and we'll be back after these messages.
listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew, which airs on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. My show interviews fascinating authors, inventors, and researchers of new understandings, techniques, and discoveries that can enhance and transform our lives. What is our potential and how can we fulfill it to the max? To find out, tune in to Energy Stew and Peter Roth at 8 p.m. Thursdays on Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis and Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde, who have written the book Flight of Mind. Before the break, you guys were mentioning how magic kind of is connected to tracing back that root of how consciousness operates, which is a pretty big deal. I think most people would agree that finding out how consciousness operates is kind of a biggie in there with human endeavors. And I was wondering if I had talked to Phil Farber last week, who studies magic as well, and I had asked him how he had experienced how through magic you can have consciousness experiences that jump from the individual to the collective to reality, like with changing the weather and things like that. And I was curious if in your guys' studies, if you experienced or looked into any of that where you saw, like, someone's mind get tricked and that jumped to a collective consciousness trick, and if that had any, if you witnessed any kind of magical show or performance that affected reality, you know, in reality, in, like, consensus reality. I was curious if you guys ever witnessed any of that in your research.
Well, we haven't witnessed any effects on reality per se. Only in the perception of reality, though, there are very strong effects. And that I wouldn't say that a consciousness or conscious experience that would jump from the individual to the collective, although that may sometimes appear to be the case, because after all of our brains are wired in a very similar way, in ways that matter. So magic audiences are going to respond very reliably, and to the magician very predictably, to certain manipulations. So they can be a common mental image and a common visual and cognitive experience.
And there are team experiences, as it were, in terms of one's attention that magicians take advantage of that can make it seem like these effects are happening. So, for example, there's a concept called joint attention, and that's where we look at each other to see what we're paying attention to all the time. So if I'm talking to you here, if we were in the same room and I looked up in the sky and pointed, you would immediately look up to see what I was looking at and where I was pointing. And this happens even with more subtle things. If I look over at the door, quick glance, you may turn your head and look to see who's there and what I'm paying attention to. And so this is joint attention, where one person's interest can draw another person's interest, and magicians use this kind of thing all the time in order to manipulate where they want people to be paying attention while they do a secret move somewhere else.
I want to ask another question somewhat along these lines. In this first half, Suzanne had mentioned the fact that the goal of all of this magical operations is the creation of the magical experience. And one of the things that I would have loved to have read more of in your book is a little more discussion about what that state is, this state of astonishment. And if you can talk about why it happens, we have certain causal expectations that are frustrated, and then in that moment, we suddenly recognize that our models are not working, and there's a kind of whatever, there's an experience. It has pleasure, it has wonder, it has awe, it has a fear. It's a very peculiar and very unusual state of consciousness, and a very delicious one for those of us who enjoy magic acts. So I'd love to hear you guys reflect a little bit about that state from a cognitive science point of view, or even a sociobiological one. Why do we have this, or what does it tell us about the brain?
Well, it's difficult to ask why questions in biology, but I do agree that it's a very special experience, this feeling of wonderment that we do experience in magic shows. You said that you miss seeing more discussion of it in Slice of Mind. The fact is that there's really what we know today about the brain doesn't really allow us to make very strong conclusions about how that is implemented at the neural level. I would really love to have a neural correlate, or not the neural basis of that experience. I think that would be extremely important to cognitive and consciousness research, but we're really far right now with what we know about the brain to be able to explain a complex experience like that.
I agree, and one of the things, you know, just to talk about something that's kind of related and maybe playing a role in this would be something like startle. And so we've all been startled where something happens and we jump and that we get goosebumps and we have this feeling of if you will astonishment or something related to astonishment with fear mixed in, etc. And this may be part of what's happening when you feel astonishment in a magic trick as well. And there is some neurobiological basis to understanding startle. So there are specific neural circuits in the brain that mediate the reaction to startle. There are, in fact, these neural circuits have specific channels, which are like little tiny proteins inside the cells that allow certain types of ions to flow inside and out that mediate the quick reactions and signaling that's happening during startle. And in fact, there are people who have startle syndrome. So these are diseases where the startle part of the brain is actually messed up, and they overdo it. So there's, in fact, it's genetic. It runs in families, and there's a specific family that descended from the French that live partly in New Orleans and partly in the Acadia area of the United States and southern Canada, north of Maine. And these people who come from the same genetic stock, they actually are a family of up in the north, a family of lumberjacks, and this can be a problem because you go and you approach them, you startle them, it's possible for them to kill you because they'll throw their axe at you, and so they have these incredibly large reactions that made it very clear that the startle syndrome was real. It was a real medical effect that was happening in families, and that we had to understand more in the brain. And so when neuroscientists went in and actually looked at what was happening in the brains of these people, they found this genetic anomaly. And so it's not that you can't answer it neurobiologically. It's just that we can't answer it yet because we don't know enough.
It's interesting because to tie that in with magic tricks, I mean, that goes into like the fight or flight response, really, it sounds like, from what you're describing. And that is like kind of like in nature, right? When you have misdirection, like when they try and trick you, like with a rattlesnake, I mean, the initial thing is a startle or a horror. And even I know like in Jungian psychology, they call that state of wonder, that magic state of wonder is called like mysterium tremens. And there is always this kind of terror affiliated with it, this kind of absolute horror and terror when you see something that you're not expecting to see. You get startled and kind of terrorized a little bit, and part of that kicks in this really kind of primal part of your brain, that kind of fight or flight. When you see something you think is impossible, your reaction to it kind of like goes into that terror spot. But then it's that line between wonder and terror and how those two are related that I think is amazing that magic elicits. Did you guys find that you ever had like any of that like kind of terror when you were witnessing some of these magic things, or not so much?
I think people noticed that when they were watching us, maybe.
And I think a side of that, maybe it's a different frame of that, a similar kind of question, is the element of fear that I think that I've had at times, that's of course mixed in with wonder and pleasure, is not like a fight or flight thing. It's really more a fear about I'm now having an immediate, incontrovertible evidence, or I'm having incontrovertible evidence that the way that I think the world works, the way that I'm confidently and comfortably operate inside my little reality slice, is just not the case. And that all of these aspects of the way that I construct reality, the way I depend on my constructions of reality, are incomplete. That they are not only incomplete, but they're manipulable. And that experience, I think, is a more kind of maybe a good point to make, because ultimately, towards the end of your book, you argue that from neurophysical point of view, that some of these great fundamentals of our human experience, like free will, are really essentially kinds of illusions. They're different illusions than misdirection, but they are, in a way, confabulations that the brain is creating. And so, in that sense, the way that magic reveals the gaps and hidden error system, of our brains, of our minds, it actually opens up into a really fundamental kind of engagement with how our whole experiences are, in some ways, from some perspectives, an illusion.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Most of our experience is illusory. To some extent, we think that we experience reality as it is, but our subjective experience is really quite different, and in some cases it's diametrically opposite from what's out there, and that this is only, we don't realize most of the time, only when somebody makes us realize, like a magician in a magic show, or if we go see we read a book on visual illusions, for instance. We are confronted with the discrepancy between illusion and reality, but it's a fundamental difference that operates in everyday life.
So we are, what's happening with us in our lives as we experience our lives, is that we basically have little bits of information that are actually really pretty crappy coming in from our sensory systems. There's really not that much information. So, for example, if you hold your hand out in front of you with your elbow straight and your arm straight out in front of you with your thumb up, and you look at your thumbnail, at that distance, your thumbnail is about 1 degree of visual angle. Okay, so that means that if you had 360 thumbs, you'd have all the way, it'd go all the way around your head and make a circle, okay? Now, that 1 degree of visual angle of the size of your thumbnail is about the size of your fovea, which is the very center of your visual system, and that's the only part of your vision that you actually have high resolution vision. Everywhere else on your retina, everywhere else in your visual field, from except for the very center of where you're looking, about the size of your thumbnail at arm's reach, is you're basically legally blind. Okay? And so if you imagine that the visual system is the richest sensory system we have, and even in our visual system, we can only 1/1000th of our visual field is actually high resolution, the rest is basically, you know, blurry, then you realize that just how poor our sensory systems are. That translates into about 1 million wires coming from your eye into your brain, and you think, wow, that's a lot, 1 million. Well, the fact is that means there's about 1 million pixels in each eye. And if you consider that compared to your cell phone camera, you'll realize that your cell phone camera at 5 megapixels or 3 megapixels is better than our eye, even though it makes these crappy photographs, and our eye seems like such a much richer experience. And the reason that this all comes together is that even though our sensory systems are sending this kind of sparse information into our brains are taking this information and building this immense and really illusory simulation of reality, and that's really what we're living in at any given time. We're basically these electrochemical signals roaming around inside our brain, and we're driving this meat robot, which we call our body, that's creating this simulation of reality for us. And some of that, we're not saying the reality outside isn't real, it is, but we've never been there. We've never even been there for a short visit. All we've ever experienced is this simulation in our brain that's created based on some of the information from the outside. And so that's why magic fundamentally can work, is because virtually everything we're experiencing is just this kind of sparse information from the real world that's kind of extrapolated into this amazing illusion that we call our conscious experience.
Well, I want to push on this a little bit because it's such a fascinating point. I think, like a lot of people, I've gone through and I've taken on that model that you just described and go, well, what would it be like to live my life if I really, like, quote-unquote, experienced that? But, of course, I can't really experience it however much I read about it and believe it and understand the arguments for it. And in a way, something similar happens, but in a much more constrained way with the magic performance. And here's what I mean, is that, again, it's like I said at the opening of the show, I can go into a magic performance fully convinced there's no supernatural activity going on, totally aware, I've read your book, I know the cognitive principles, I even know how a number of tricks work, because as you get to know magicians, you inevitably start to, like, move into their world and things like this. And yet, despite all that, I'm sitting there and I'm still astonished. I'm still experiencing this kind of wonder that has a specific reality construction element to it that implies that maybe something's different. And that blows me away, that I still have that experience, that I'm not inured to, that I don't, you know, I'm not, oh, yeah, I've been there, done that. Like, I don't burn out on it in a way. And it's almost the same kind of situation. I can't stop, you know, enjoying or experiencing the illusion of being myself, however much I accept a reductive perspective. So in a way, magic is really key to the condition that we're in, as, you know, in being inside our minds in these beat robots, simulation machines.
In a number of the illusions, both in and out of magic shows, work in that fashion. That is, if you are confronted with a number of classic visual illusions that you may find in the Magic Eye or other illusion books, that what you're experiencing, what you're perceiving, it's not really what's out there. But even though you know, you cannot keep yourself from perceiving the illusion, and that makes it all that much more interesting. I think that if you are anything like us, the more that you have learned about magic from your conversations with magicians and just learning about it over time, the more that you are getting to appreciate it.
Very much. I had one question for you, Suzanne. Slightly off topic, because since you're on the phone, I get to figure it out. Is that I read something? I believe it was in the New Scientist just a few months ago that was made the claim that some visual illusions that work, you know, very consistently on me and all the people that I know in my, you know, Western American educated world, don't actually, like, simple visual illusions don't work the same way for an African nomad who's basically living on the margins of our sort of technological Western reality. So some things that were thought to be purely, some illusions that were thought to be based on purely physiological elements of the visual system have more, whatever, higher order or kind of cognitive expectations involved in. Is that the case, or did I misread that?
I'm not exactly sure what particular studies you're talking about, but I do know that there are some papers out there that I have studied and that I have found a bias in the perception of a particular illusions for people who have lived all their lives in an urban environment versus people who lived in a less technologically developed societies and are not used to seeing skyscrapers and that kind of thing. I think a lot of these studies, some of these claims have been overstated a little bit, and that when such effects are found, they're relatively subtle, and that still, even if you can find some exceptions and biases, the commonalities far outweigh the cultural differences. And that, as an example, speaking again about magic, in writing Slides of Mind, we were curious as to whether we might find a difference between Asian magic and Western magic. And in fact, we, as part of our journey, we went to the Magic Championship, the World Championship in FISM, that was in Beijing in 2009, and there we had the opportunity to see dozens, if not hundreds, of magical acts by Western trained magicians and by Asian magicians of various kinds, some classical magic, some more contemporary magic, and that in the end we couldn't conclude that there was really a cultural difference. There are some stylistic differences about the magic, the way of making magic to make it more appealing to one audience versus another. But in the end, what you're going to be fooled by, if you're an Asian person, is going to be the same as if you're a Western person. So Asian magic works with Western audiences, and the other way around. Our brains are really much more common than different, regardless of nationality and culture.
Well, I think part of that too stems into like the history of magic. Like, you can read that, there's that Net of Magic book, right, that talks about how like Western origins of magic go to like India and China, and how like a lot of the influence of Western magic actually comes from those places in the first place. And then, I mean, you can take it back all the way and see like origins of tricks and things, how they're like shamanic, and then of course like they're from shamans from cultures all over the world. So I think like, I mean, that just speaks not only to the universality of our minds, but that these tricks would appear in people that would perform them all over the globe, that they would like emerge from these traditions everywhere, I think is pretty interesting, especially when you relate it back to like our kind of innate state of how consciousness originates, like you were talking about earlier. I think that's just like a metaphor of that, really.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to find out a little bit about what the future lies has for you guys in terms of what's the next stage for your own research, and also what's the next stage for your own magic. Do you want to become better magicians as well? How does those two worlds interact as you go forward?
Well, in terms of our magic, we were so thrilled to get into the Magic Castle, but they did make it very clear that we shouldn't quit our day job. So we're not going to be presenting ourselves as great magicians anytime soon, or potentially ever. But in terms of like the research has really started picking up. So it's not only just with us, but we're happy that our initiative is kind of catching on, and there's quite a number of labs now studying magic. In our own labs, we've been working directly with Apollo Robbins, Matt King, and Teller, where we've now filmed them doing specific tricks and specific experimental situations, so that we can then test the perception of subjects while they actually view these video clips, and we can scientifically measure, for instance, what's happening with their eye position, what's happening with their attentional position, what's happening with their detection of certain magical events that, as a function of time or as a function of various conditions. And we're also working with internationally with a number of magicians, and we're to create virtual magicians who can do magic and do things in specific speeds and specific distances, so we can really start to test how and the limits of magic and how it is they're actually working. And that'll give us the chance to find out eventually what's happening inside the brain when you experience these things.
It's interesting to think, just a few minutes left, how magic itself might change as this dialogue intensifies. The whole framework that we think of with conjuring magic itself is really only about 100 years old. I mean, it has relationships with earlier things, and it might change quite significantly.
Yes, absolutely. I agree that magic will certainly be affected by the science. In fact, that's already started happening. We've already seen Darren Brown and Penn and Teller have integrated into their acts situations that were created for the scientific laboratory, specifically from Dan Simon's laboratory and others, where this has become a very viable aspect of a terrific magic act. But we'll also see not only the feedback into magic, but also the understanding of how the brain works, and also the realization by magicians that they can actually approach this from a magical method will, I think, improve magic's the magician's ability to create tricks and to make robust, strong tricks. So it'll kind of bounce back and forth on each other. And for example, one of the things that we discovered in our research was that in the way the spotlight of attention is working, when we actually looked in the brain to find out how that happens, we found that in attention, instead of what the dogma, which is where you're paying attention with your spotlight, everything's enhanced, and then everything else in the surround is suppressed. What we found is specifically in the early visual system that the neurons that are enhanced are actually inhibitory neurons. So those are the neurons that are actually suppressing all of the surround information, and that the surround information that's being suppressed specifically in the early visual system is about moving objects, about motion. And so this kind of detailed information are things that clues that can be used to give magicians hints about how to make stronger tricks by understanding exactly how attention works in the brain, and instead of just kind of figuring it out through trial and error.
Yeah, I was just going to, my final point about this wonderful book, and I really recommend people read Sleights of Mind, is that I thought at the beginning, especially because there are a lot of spoilers in the book, like, oh, it's once again the scientists come along and disenchant the rainbow, and it's really not the case at all. I think that this is a part of a dialogue that's going to move forward, and congratulations, you guys, on your work. I also want to let people know that they can go to the ever-present interwebs and go to sleightsofmind.com, and in addition to finding out more about Susanna and Stephen, you can see a number of really wonderful clips there, so it's a great place to see some of the tricks and performances that are in the book. So thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, from Eric Davis and Maja Daou, keep your minds open.